Pamela Lee è assistant professor al Dipartimento di Arte e Storia dell'Arte dell'Università di Stanford. Nel 2000, la Meat Press ha pubblicato il suo Object to be Destroyed, uno dei maggiori e più esaustivi contributi critici sul lavoro di Gordon Matta Clark, qui esaminato all'interno del contesto artistico della fine degli anni 60, inizio anni 70, e alla luce del coinvolgimento politico e sociale di molti artisti di quella generazione e del contemporaneo dibattito su proprietà, architettura e spazio urbano. Ed è proprio a partire dalla comunità artistica di Soho e del ruolo di collante sociale che Matta Clark vi esercitava che Pamela Lee inizia a parlarci di lui.
He was formative in the development of Soho as an artistic community and as a place. Soho is that area in Lower Manhattan which has at this point now become a very popular shopping and tourist destination, but in the 60s it was considered quite unlivable and dangerous place. It was a place that had in the 19th century and early 20th century been the site of a great deal of industrial production. But due to the changes in industrial production and in labor around mid-century and even earlier, it had become progressively evacuated of its local inhabitants. And so Gordon Matta Clark was part of a community of artists who settled, we could say, or helped gentrify Soho by virtue of building up alternative exhibition spaces, performance spaces, and a restaurant he co-founded called Food, which became a kind of watering hole or gathering place for many performers, musicians, artists, this group of artists who we associate with spaces like 112 Green Street, different kind of performance communities, etc. In that regard, his role was as much social as aesthetic, social in terms of organizing around him and bringing together very diverse group of individuals who were all collaborating, who believed very strongly in the power of artistic collaboration, and who we know today is among the most important artists of that particular moment. So that was perhaps one of his most obvious roles, but you could also say that in terms of his coming up in Soho, that by virtue of his training in architecture, he was able to experiment in the most pragmatic and material way possible with the materials of the built environment. And that's where his work in building interventions into architectural cuttings began to evolve, right there. For him, his being in the world as a social subject, as someone who cared deeply about community, as someone who cared deeply about collaboration, as someone who cared about artistic practice as a social practice, as a practice that had very real material implications for the built environment, for local communities, I think that his works brought all of these things together. And one thing that must be said is that we can't just reduce his work to his interventions into buildings. I mean, those are obviously his most important and biggest pieces, but the performance-oriented aspect of his work and the fact that his work was implicitly calling upon a local community or a spectator to engage it in a very physical and tangible way, I think, dramatizes something of the ethical dimension of his practice, which is to understand architecture's relationship to social space and to its uses by a local community. He did actual projects involving the local community within the Lower East Side, I mean, attempting to build up various kind of recreational centers there. The artistic community, though, is a local community, and it's a community that one can't necessarily separate from a local population or demographic outside it, particularly when you think about places like Soho, later on someplace like the Lower East Side, in which artists were trying to make a living, trying to find affordable places to work and to live, and many were under the same kind of social and financial pressures as any of the other communities who lived there. So you can't I don't think it's entirely fair to make the distinction between the artistic communities and, say, the underprivileged communities that his work was implicitly addressing as well. As long as artists have been artists, they have always engaged in a social relation, whether or not as activists or implicitly by virtue of the kind of forms, say, that are available to them to create their work. I think in the case of Matta Clark, if you speak to anyone of his generation, of those artists who were living in Soho in the 60s and the early 70s, you will hear a note of a faint note of melancholy in their recollections, not only, of course, because Matta Clark is gone, but because the sense of possibility, the sense of what it was that artists were allowed to do or what they thought they could do or an almost naivete about their relationship to the world is very, very different from obviously what we experience today. One talks about the globalization of the art world, and I think what comes with that territory is the sense that artists are entrepreneurial, that they have been professionalized, that the art world has itself been corporatized, and I think that's entirely true. And while it is also true to say that artists have always worked creatively with the market and around the market and in critique of the market, there is as well a qualitative difference between how the art world was experienced and inhabited at that time than what we have now. So the problems that artists face as activists today are much more complicated. It's not to say that those problems didn't exist before, but they're much more complicated now. I think that we do his work a disservice when we don't take seriously the physicality and the materiality of the process, that there was a kind of, there's a real physical labor and energy involved in his engagement and intervention into architecture. And so one would want to stress then the almost performative nature of his intervention, the dramatic nature, and for better or for worse, the spectacular nature of his cuttings. This is an aspect which has come under some critique by some writers, but nevertheless, one has to deal with the notion that this is not exclusively, but for the most part, the work of one person going into these spaces and cutting up the architecture. But I think that the space-time issue and the process issue vis-a-vis Matta Clark's architectural interventions is in some ways best encapsulated or best captured by recollections of his friends, who always talk about what a fantastic dancer Matta Clark was. And they have these wonderful anecdotes about dancing with him in the clubs and in the bars in Soho and in people's lofts and whatnot, and how he had this extraordinary gift for dancing with a partner and then being able to throw that partner around in such a way that it expressed, I mean, on the one hand, it would seem to be something quite, you know, physically almost dangerous, but the description of these partnerships is that when he did that to a dancing partner, there was a genuine understanding of weight and mass and the human body. And for some of his friends, that became a kind of metaphor for how he dealt with physical space, in that these were not mere anarchic slash-and-burn cuttings of buildings. They were genuine ways to choreograph the space and to choreograph the viewer's relation to the space. There was a kind of sensitivity to how his audience would negotiate and move through those spaces that suggests an understanding of the temporal dimension of our experience of architecture. And that is reflected ultimately in the notion that Matta Clark understood space's relationship to place as one that was ephemeral, as one that needed to be highlighted in his work. And so when I talk about, in my work on Matta Clark, that this was an object to be destroyed, I don't mean necessarily to highlight the nihilistic aspect of his work, because I don't think it's nihilistic. I think, though, that there is this sense about the temporality and the timeliness of these buildings that is captured by the spatial dimensions of these buildings. You know, I mean, they were extraordinary things, and as a historian, I wish I had been able to see it. But I think that part of what he did and the power of what he did was to dramatize the precariousness of our relationship to the built environment through these works that were not made for the ages, in a way. Well, I think it would have something to do with the evocation of the domestic and the private sphere. The critiques have largely been feminist in their inflection, in the sense that, as I mentioned earlier, there was, in some respects, something quite macho about what he was doing. I mean, you get a guy with a chainsaw scaling up the side of a building and cutting into a house, and for quite a few people, that automatically symbolized something about the violence against the domestic sphere, against the private sphere, which is conventionally coded as the sphere of feminine productivity. And I think that critique, I mean, surely you can't deny that if you see somebody with a chainsaw and a hammer, that it's going to have violent associations. But I would argue that one would want to take seriously in his work this sort of endlessly dialectical relationship between inside and outside, between private and public, between the containerization of space considered the suburban home and the outside world, the public sphere of the city and whatnot. And that's what he thought he was doing. He thought he was actually liberating that space, not violating it. I think a metaphor one critic used to describe this kind of gesture was that it was like a quote-unquote rape, and I know that there was something that he reacted very strongly against. No, in fact, he thought that this was to liberate the space and to prize open this cliché around the domestic sphere that had been conventionally understood as the feminine sphere. He talked about growing up in New York in those old apartment buildings where the spaces between buildings was quite small, and having that experience that many Manhattanites do, many New Yorkers do, of being able to look directly into somebody else's window. And voyeurism for him was part of the built environment and was very much a part of the modernist environment, in that all these skyscrapers studded with these windows, you know, these gridded facades with windows all over them, was enabling that kind of spectatorship. So he was interested in voyeurism. Chinatown Voyeur was the name of one of his videos. I don't think, not necessarily in a prurient way, certainly, but as a function of how architecture is constantly exposing perspectives, is enabling perspectives as well as foreclosing them. So that's, again, to think dialectically about his project, the equal but opposite condition of the containerization of the home within the suburbs and whatnot. The cards are displayed not just as artistic, as notes, you know, for the artist to work from, but there's an almost poetic dimension to them, you know. I mean, I think that when you have the experience of looking at enough notes by artists, you get the sense that there's a real care taken with just the graphic dimension almost of them. And so there's something like concrete poetry a bit in how those words and those images are displayed that makes them, I think, really quite illuminating to read with respect to the rest of his practice. I was, and I remain, intrigued about the space-time problematic within 20th century art and contemporary art. And I was and remained engaged with how both of these conditions of our experience, if one was going to be sort of Kantian about it, how they're politicized and how they affect us as social beings as we in turn condition those conditions. And Mata Clark, it seemed to me, really understood that at a moment in the history of New York, but also globally, but specifically with New York as his foundation, in which questions of the public sphere, in which questions of urban blight and urban development are really coming to the fore, and in which problems with homelessness and the economy of New York City are at the forefront of everyone's minds. And so to take something that seems as abstract as our relationship to time and to space, and to find such, I think, beautiful and crystalline articulation of these problems in his work was something that always really compelled me. Well, it's clear that Matta Clark has become a hero for younger architects, and not just the so-called deconstructivist architects who followed closely on his example in the late 70s and early 80s. I think that simply the notion of some form of recycling, however partial, the notion that one would want to be attentive to preservation in some aspect, and to be sensitive to the dynamics of social and political community around aspects of preservation. I know younger architects have taken extremely seriously, and obviously it's not just Matta Clark's example that provides an object lesson, but one thing that is clear to me after speaking with many architects in architecture school in the United States about Matta Clark's inspiration is that there's always a sense that the directness with which he worked with buildings, the sort of fearlessness with which he was able to take on these huge questions around urban blight, around homelessness, around sort of accelerated cycles of building production and destruction is something that I suspect many young architects really wish that they could do. Because, of course, architecture is the most practical and functional of the arts. The kinds of considerations around bureaucracy and code and whatnot can't simply be jettisoned by those artists. And so Matta Clark, for them, enables a way of thinking creatively about how to make use and make do what is already there. And so I think that's the biggest part of his legacy for them.